Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Juan Manuel Benitez, filling in for Brian today. In September 2016, the death of six-year-old Zymir Perkins after he was he died after he was allegedly beaten to death by his mother and her boyfriend, and that was the latest reminder of the inefficiencies of the child welfare system. A state order report of Zymir's case found that the city's Administration for Children's Services knew about his troubled home life from five incidents handled by the agency in 2010, yet failed to intervene in a meaningful way. My next guest says, while there have been some incremental changes in individual child welfare systems and new federal and state legislation, cases like Zymir's have continually plagued America's child welfare system for over two decades. Joining me now is Richard Gelis. He's a former dean and chair of the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy. He spent 20 years studying the child welfare system, and in his new book, Out of Harm's Way, Creating an Effective Child Welfare System, he takes an in-depth look into the most enduring problems of the child welfare system and offers up some solutions. Welcome to WNYC, Richard.
Thank you.
Are you familiar with the case of Zymir Perkins?
I am.
And from your research, how prevalent do you think cases like this one are?
Well, there are 2,000 children who are killed by caregivers every year. Of that number, 1,000 are children who themselves or their siblings or their caregivers are already known to the Child Protective Service system. So twice a day, three times a day. It's common enough. I think it's obviously more common in large cities, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles.
And in your book, you point out that the last significant fiscal investment in child welfare was in 1993. How much is the state of our child welfare a funding issue?
I really don't think it's a funding issue. The big increase in 1993 was for family preservation and preservation. The amount of money for foster care is substantial. It's upwards of $10 billion a year. And frankly, in the book, I said that's a perverse incentive. We've got more money and we use it badly. So I don't think the problem is necessarily going to be found at the federal level needing more money. We need to take the money that we're using and use it in a much more informed, intelligent fashion.
And according to Politico, Trump's proposal, his budget proposal, completely eliminates the $3 billion Community Development Block Grant Program, which is used by a number of city agencies. Do you think, like in places like New York City, if this block grant is eliminated, and that will have a really significant impact in agencies like ACS, the Administration for Children's Services?
Well, the block grant is designed to prevent child abuse or to be available to provide services after child abuse has taken place. It's not money that normally would run through ACS. What it's going to do if that money is eliminated is it's going to exacerbate the causes of child abuse and neglect and drive more families to an already overburdened agency.
And in your book, you identify what you refer to as four key centers of gravity that you say must and can be changed to improve the child welfare system. What's the center of gravity approach you refer to?
The center of gravity is basically saying, look, where does the system have the greatest ability to move and change? And where is that change going to have the greatest effect on its core mission, which is the safety and well-being of children? Number one center of gravity, and you could see it in the Zymir case, is the ambivalence that ACS administrators and line staff have about who's their client. They get a lot of pressure from family and parent advocates that they exist to serve and provide services to families. The reality is that ACS exists to protect and ensure the well-being of children. When that case broke, a lot of the commentary was, well, we really try to balance safety and preservation. And the bottom line is, you can't do that. You have to prioritize one over the other. And if you are trying to balance it, you're going to fail on both ends. You're going to fail to preserve families, and you're going to grossly fail to protect children.
Well, listeners, have you had experience with the child welfare system and want to discuss problems you've observed with our local administration for children's services and want to discuss this with my guest, Richard Gullis, a former dean and chair of the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And as part of the chapter in your book that looks at making children the client of the child welfare system, you discuss the racial disproportionality of the system. African-American families and children are disproportionate clients of the system. From your research, why is that the case?
Some people would argue that it's racist and that the families are being profiled. In the course of doing research over the last almost 50 years, the factors that lead people to abuse and neglect their children are disproportionately found in poor communities and in minority communities and in oppressed communities. So I don't think it's a question of being profiled. I think it's the factors that produce child abuse and neglect are unfortunately disproportionately distributed to communities that are poor, marginalized, and are oppressed by the rest of society.
And you point out that the belief of eliminating poverty will solve child maltreatment. Is that true? Is that a myth? What do you think?
You know, if I had a magic wand and I could eliminate poverty, I could probably eliminate 35-40% of child abuse and neglect. I don't have that magic wand, and I don't live in an environment right now that even is thinking that way. But I'd still have 67% of the cases left once poverty was gone, because a lot of child abuse and neglect is really not primarily caused by poverty. It's caused by other factors, relationship factors, personality factors, ability to cope with children factors, being brought up in a violent environment on yourself factors. So that the elimination of poverty, as fanciful as that seems in 2017, is not the ultimate solution, although it certainly would lower the caseload.
And another of the four centers of gravity is the decision-making process in the child welfare system and how technology must be employed to improve the decision-making. What is the state of the way technology is used in the current child welfare system?
Well, there's a lot of technology, and it's used badly. Look, I can tell you what the highest level of technology is for the people who made decisions in the Zamir case, and that is reach into your pocket, take out a quarter, and flip it. And that quarter flip will be as accurate as the clinical judgment that folks use in making life and death decisions on a day-to-day basis. In terms of knowing where children are, there was a second case in New York where the caseworkers who were working a weekend shift went to the wrong house, didn't know where the child was. Now, you know, that's in 2017. That's unforgivable. You've got to have the ability to know where families live. I say in the book, if you order a pizza from Domino's Pizza, you know more about that pizza from the time the dough is flipped until the time it's delivered to you than ACS knows about the children and its care. They cannot tell you where children are today in real time, and yet they are the legal custodian for those children, and they have the complete responsibility for those children's safety and well-being.
So I read in the New York Post that you support the use of algorithms, similar to the way insurance companies use them to predict risk, and there are ways to measure the risk for a child remaining in a home where there's evidence of abuse. For example, you've said social workers tend to underestimate the added risk of the presence of a mother's boyfriend in the home. This seemed to be true in the case of Zymir Perkins. Can you discuss this in more detail?
Well, number one, we have a lot of information about children and families. We don't aggregate it into a single place. The Center for Medical Services, which has Medicaid data and Medicare data, has almost all the data you need to know about the status of children and their families. It's not accessed by ACS. Secondly, I go back to my quarter metaphor, ACS is still relying on clinical judgment. They're still sending out bachelor-trained workers, under-trained workers to make clinical judgments when 50 years of research on clinical judgment shows isn't appreciably better than flipping a coin. The pushback on algorithms is going to be, at the beginning, they are going to be based on what's come to public attention. And so there's a certain amount of profiling that's going to be built into the algorithm at the beginning. Over time, those algorithms self-correct because they're corrected on real-time basis, on real-time behavior. So any racism or classism that's going to exist at the front end of the algorithm correction, creation, will eventually correct itself over time. The systems don't want to do it. I don't really understand the logic of not wanting to do it. They keep saying, well, it'll be biased. It isn't going to be any more biased than it is now. It's going to be a whole lot less biased than clinical judgment, which we know is grossly biased.
Let's take some phone calls. We have Matilda in Westchester. Matilda, good morning. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I came to America in 1954 as an Italian immigrant, couldn't speak a word of English. Social services came to my mom in Hell's Kitchen at the time, and they said she couldn't leave us home alone, which was true, and even though in Italy we were allowed to do that, and forced her to send us to foster care for the summer while she worked in a factory. Unfortunately, the screening that was done was not very well timed, and my brother was sent to one home where they did speak Italian. I was sent to another home where not only did they not speak Italian, I didn't have a private bedroom. I wound up being left alone with a baby to care, and I was abused terribly. So my question is, and that was Fresh Air Fund through the Herald Tribune, which is how it worked at that time. My question is, how do they monitor, supervise, follow up on children that are sent who cannot speak English, nor can the family speak English? And we were legal immigrants. It's not as if we came here illegally. So social services intervened, and because of them, I was violently abused. That's my question.
Thank you, Matilda.
Well, in 1954, they probably didn't have particularly good screening devices. In 1954, they were continuing the legacy of intruding into immigrant families. In 2017, they're still doing the same thing. They're still using clinical judgment to screen foster families. There's a lawsuit pending in New York City against ACS where a child who didn't speak Spanish was put into a Spanish-speaking home only. And the requirements for ACS are they only see their child once a month. And frankly, ACS is lucky if they see half the children in foster care once a month. So go back to big data. You need a lot better data and a lot better judgment and a lot better technology to determine if children need to be placed, where children need to be placed, and how to follow up on the children who are placed.
Do you think the city right now is implementing policies that will make the system better, or are they still lacking greatly on the findings that people like you have done in the last few decades?
They have a new commissioner, Dan Hansel, who came out of the administration of children and families in the Obama administration. Dan's a good guy. He's a smart guy. But to use a metaphor that people don't necessarily like these days, Dan's going to find himself up to his ass in alligators very quickly. And he's going to not have an awful lot of time to drain the swamp. No one has implemented in New York City the kind of solutions in terms of being child-focused and data-driven that some smaller jurisdictions are playing with. Allegheny County is now beginning to use big data. So, no. Is New York doing it? No. New York is still coming out of a period of time where they were under the misimpression and the misunderstanding they could balance safety and preservation. Whether Dan can get his arms around this and forge an agency that has a clear vision of who their client is and bring up-to-date technology to bear, he's not going to have a lot of time to do it, but time will tell.
Richard Gillis, former dean and chair of the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy, his book, Out of Harm's Way, Creating an Effective Child Welfare System. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, tips about what to do and what not to do at a job interview. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. Don't go away.